From WGCU News, this is Gulf Coast Life. I'm Mike Canary. Dr. Stephen Knott has spent his career learning about, teaching about, and writing about presidents of the United States of America. He's a professor of American history and government at Ashland University in Ohio and emeritus professor of national security affairs at the U.S. Naval War College. Dr. Knott was also co-chair of the Presidential Oral History Program at the Miller Center of Public Affairs at the University of Virginia. He's the author of 11 books dealing with the American presidency, the early republic, and American foreign policy. In 2022, he published Coming to Terms with John F. Kennedy, and in 2019, The Lost Soul of the American Presidency, The Decline into Demagoguery, and the Prospects for Renewal. His latest book, which is due out in May, is Conspirator-in-Chief, The Long Tradition of Conspiracy Theories in the American Presidency, which details, through extensive research and citations, the ways, according to his telling, eight United States commanders-in-chief used conspiracy theories to advance their causes. They were examples, he would say, of the kinds of demagogues the country's founders were concerned could someday take on the role. He was in Southwest Florida last week to give two talks about his new book, one at FGCU as part of the university's provost seminar series, the other for the Naples discussion group. He stopped by our studio on Thursday. Let's hear that conversation now. Dr. Knott, welcome back to the show. It's good to see you.
Thanks for having me again. It's always a privilege.
So we talked 2 years ago, March of 2024. We actually recorded it like exactly 2 years ago. I looked back on it. And in that conversation about your ninth book, The Lost Soul of the American Presidency, we glazed past conspiracy theories and presidencies. And you said like, oh, that's actually going to be my next book that I'm working on, which is the book that we're here to talk about today. What's it been like writing this book during these times?
I would say it hasn't been a particularly uplifting experience, although the book does end on a somewhat uplifting note. Look, we live in a time when conspiracy theories are all the rage. And I think part of the problem is we have a president who likes to circulate those types of things in order to fire up his base. But the reason I wrote this book was in part to show that that practice has always been with us, even though I would argue under President Trump, it's reached new levels that, you know, just in terms of the sheer output of circulating these things and the fact that the American public seems to eat this up perhaps more than ever.
We'll get more into this in a bit, but do you think that's because of the medium that's available or the nature of the man?
I'd say it's both, not to sound like I'm copping out, but certainly the internet has made it very easy for both political figures and private citizens to circulate unfounded conspiracy theories. And again, I think there's just an insatiable appetite for these things because in a way they offer a nice, simplistic, usually very comprehensive, in other words, explains very complicated issues in a simple fashion. And I think President Trump, I'm not a particular fan, but he's proven to be very adept in terms of communicating with his base and using these conspiracy theories as a way, as I've said, to fire up his supporters.
So I read the advance copy of the book. When's it due out?
It's due out on May 19th of this year.
Have you given any talks like the ones you're going to give today and tomorrow, or is this kind of the breaking the first ground?
I am breaking ground here today, so I'm hoping it all goes well. This is my first one.
Have you gotten any feedback from readers?
Yeah, I've gotten feedback from external reviewers since it's published by a university press. It had to clear, I think, three external reviewers, both all of whom gave it thumbs up. And then five or six editorial reviews that the press will use for jacket blurbs, things of that sort. So far, it's been very positive.
So demagogue is something that our founders were extremely concerned about. I looked it up because I know that word kind of generally, but I'm going to define it for listeners so we know. Political leader who seeks support by appealing to the desires and prejudices of ordinary people rather than by using rational argument. Your book highlights eight presidents. Are they all demagogues?
Yes, with a slight qualifier that I think some are perhaps more bombastic, more reckless than others. And part of the reason I'm hedging or hesitating here is I don't feel particularly comfortable grouping somebody like a Thomas Jefferson or Franklin Roosevelt in with an Andrew Johnson or, in my view, a Donald Trump. So there are degrees of demagoguery, but they all employed this practice, both in terms of campaigning and also as presidents.
So some of the key unifiers that I jotted down. One, this is a quote from your book, "Rhetorical escalation is a central element of the conspiracy-mongering president. Conspiracies work because rational arguments require work and demand that citizens exercise the faculty of reason. It requires citizenry to weigh the pros and cons of complex issues. And for conspiracy theory presidents, there is no distinction drawn between themselves and the state. What's good for them is good for the state." Are those three good distillation points for these people?
Those are excellent distillation points. And the only thing I might add to that is none of these presidents, in my view, revealed any sort of growth in office. In other words, the kind of tactics that might have been successful as a candidate continued to be employed by the chief executive. So there was really no distinction between campaigning and actually governing. And I think that's a serious problem.
So the presidents that your book highlights are Thomas Jefferson, Andrew Jackson, Andrew Johnson, Woodrow Wilson, Teddy Roosevelt, FDR, Harry Truman, Richard Nixon, and Donald Trump. I did the math, and that's almost 18% of our presidents, which I guess the point being that this is not something new that we're living through now. It might just the temperature might be warmer, but the nature has always been with us since all the way back to Jefferson, who was right there at the beginning.
Oh, that's absolutely right. And what I also try to do, however, in the book is show examples of presidents who did not go down that path.
Yeah, that's how it ends.
So I try to end on a somewhat optimistic note. But for instance, in contrast to Jefferson, George Washington never engaged in that type of newspaper rumor mongering that Jefferson was very adept at. John Quincy Adams never engaged in the type of rumor mongering, personal attacks, questioning the patriotism, questioning the integrity of his opponents. So there are counterexamples to these presidents that I think did take the low road. And I try to highlight them at the very end of the book, as you mentioned.
So I'm going to go through these. We don't have time to dig into every one, but I'm going to give just a little summary that I've come up with. And you can either tell me where I'm wrong or add to it. And I don't have a summary for Truman, so be ready for a Truman summary. Jefferson, third president, 1801 to 1809. Conspiracy monger to his core. Elitists were pulling the strings to tuck it to the little guy, which somehow he included himself among. Is that pretty good for Jefferson?
That's very good, yes. Yes, and it is remarkable since he was a member of the Virginia gentry, but was able to present himself as a champion of the common man. One of the ways he was successful in doing that was to portray Alexander Hamilton and Hamilton's party, the Federalists, as Anglophiles, monarchists, if not outright British agents. So there was a real questioning of Hamilton and his fellow Federalists, questioning their loyalty to the United States, suggesting that they might in fact be British agents. Again, all of this was done through Jeffersonian newspapers. But, you know, the point was to portray his opponents as lacking loyalty or faithfulness to the new republic. And in other words, in a sense, exiling them internally.
You know, that was right at the beginning of the country. That's where the strong federal government versus states with independence was being battled out. I mean, he may have been a conspiracy theorist in what he said, but that was probably a pressing issue at that time. Is that a fair way to think of it?
It's a fair way to think of it. But I think, again, in my view, a real statesman like a George Washington or Lincoln would have avoided exploiting that type of issue. There was a concern, particularly in the old anti-Federalist people who opposed the Constitution, a lot of them drifted into Jefferson's camp. There was a concern that these centralizers, these Federalists under Washington and Hamilton, were incorporating European ideas into this new republic. And it was an easy thing, I think, for Jefferson to exploit and say, they're not only incorporating these ideas, Hamilton, in fact, is a British agent.
Andrew Jackson, 7th president, 1829 to 1837. Propagating conspiracy theories was second nature to Andrew Jackson. The essence of Jacksonian conspiracism was that there was somewhere a secret cabal at work plotting to subjugate the common man. So again, it's that common man thing. And he was a little bit more like a common man.
A little bit, although he was one of the largest slave one of the largest slave owners in Tennessee, but he was very successful at marketing himself as a rough-hewn frontiersman and a genuine military hero. But, you know, he had an easy foil with John Quincy Adams from the famous Massachusetts Adams family, a son of a president. And again, the effort was to portray John Quincy Adams, who I would argue was one of our most intelligent, best educated, had the potential to be a great statesman. The effort was to portray him as a member of a secret cabal who was intent on tucking it to white male common men. That was Jackson's common man. It did not include African Americans, certainly did not include Native Americans.
President Trump has expressed admiration for Andrew Jackson. I think in the last time we talked 2 years ago, you said that Trump was most like Andrew Jackson. Do I remember that correctly?
You remember that correctly, yes.
He claimed the election was stolen from him, for one thing, and he had a lot of turnover in his presidency. I thought that was another interesting echo.
That's right.
You mentioned, you know, he believed in the majority rule, or he used that language to wield power or gather power. This is a common theme. But as you said, he believed in white majority rule. And I don't know if this is a fair question, but I wonder if they would believe in majority rule if the majority was no longer white.
That's a fair question, and it's a tough one. And, you know, look, I have to be careful. There's a phenomenon in history writing called presentism, where you apply the standards of today to the past and you sort of, you know, issue some moral condemnation as a result of that. With that disclaimer in mind, certainly elements of the Jacksonian coalition, I think, would object to the broader franchise that we have today, whether it's minorities or women or whatever. But let me make an important point here, I think. Jackson's majoritarianism, the idea that the majority is to govern, the price paid for that was paid by unpopular minorities, whether it was free blacks in the North or Native Americans elsewhere, particularly in the South. They were the targets of this majority rule. And I think one thing most of the founders understood was pure majority rule can wreak havoc with those who are out of step with the majority. And in a way, this book and the previous one you're referring to is a plea to recognize the fact that majority rule has its consequences, and they're not particularly good if you happen to be out of step with the majority.
Andrew Johnson, 17th president, 1865 to 1869, assumed the office after Lincoln was assassinated. This is a quote from your book. Andrew Johnson's repeated assertion that the radical Republicans, the, quote, woke liberals of their day, were conspiring to create a privileged class, quote, the Negro, quote, echo to this day. That was my distillation of Johnson.
Yeah, you nailed it. I would argue that Andrew Johnson was our most blatantly racist president. I'm not one of those people who throws that word around loosely, but it's warranted in Johnson's case. He was repeatedly warning his fellow Americans that if the so-called radical Republicans and the Civil War amendments that freed the slaves, gave the slaves the right to vote, male slaves the right to vote, and protected their civil liberties, if they were allowed to exercise those rights, we would live in a regime of Negro supremacy, as he was fond of saying, and that they were going to trample on the rights of the white man. So, you know, it was a blatant appeal to racism in that he felt that Negroes or blacks, excuse me, were unable to govern themselves. And, you know, again, as you mentioned, I think that message resonates to this day.
And they tried to impeach him but failed, and in some ways that set a precedent for presidential impeachments, not, you know, what it takes to require an impeachment.
That's right. And I think that's unfortunate. We've had a number of failed presidential impeachments. It hasn't been healthy for the American political order, for separation of powers. Some of the charges against Andrew Johnson were trumped up. But the fact was, this was the chief executive who's supposed to take care that the laws be faithfully executed, and he wasn't doing that. He was not enforcing the new Civil War amendments that guaranteed certain protections for the freed slaves. He was derelict in his duty, and he should have been impeached. We've developed, Mike, a kind of devotion to, if you don't break a particular law, then you can't be impeached. That wasn't the founders' understanding. If you're abusing your power or refusing to enforce the law, you can and should be impeached. Johnson should have been impeached.
Woodrow Wilson, who was a progressive, so we're now in kind of a different camp politically. I didn't really know much about Wilson, but I wrote, super racist. Erased true history of blacks at Princeton while he was president at Princeton. Screened Birth of a Nation at the White House and liked it. Administration filled with white supremacists. That was Woodrow Wilson.
That is correct. And it's kind of, when you think of Wilson, he's our only PhD president. He was president of Princeton University. But he had some pretty, in my view, pretty regressive opinions and policies. And in addition to everything you mentioned, his presidency was probably one of the worst in terms of stirring the pot, getting his fellow citizens to think first of German Americans during the First World War as potential subversives. And there were some lynchings and a lot of attacks against German Americans during World War I. And then following World War I, he went after socialists and alleged communists for so-called un-American activities. This is one of the most repressive administrations in American history. And I should add to that, that administration, with Wilson's approval, encouraged the American people to report on their neighbors. If they were seen as pro-German or perhaps having socialist or communist sympathies, turn them into the Justice Department.
It was the sort of beginning of the real versus hyphenated American argument, which lives on.
That is correct. That is correct.
FDR, 32nd president, 1933 until he died in 1945. Roosevelt raised fear-mongering to a rarefied art form, thought the Reconstruction era was America's dark ages. I wouldn't have said that about FDR. By the way, if you're listening to this, you should read the book because it is, each chapter is filled with, you have 38 footnote pages at the back. So it's filled with examples of things that were either said or said on their behalf. But yeah, FDR.
Yeah, look, there's a lot about FDR that I admire. I think his optimism buoyed the American public during the Great Depression, one of our worst economic collapses ever. I think he assembled a team of generals and admirals to pursue the Second World War in a remarkably effective manner. So all credit to FDR for that. But a lot of times, FDR's rhetoric through his fireside chats over the radio and through his public speeches were attacks directed against either the Supreme Court or Congress or Americans who were not in step with the New Deal. And I think a president who uses the power of the bully pulpit to attack his fellow citizens is precisely the type of demagogic, conspiracy-mongering president that I'm condemning in this book and arguing for an alternative conception of presidential power.
And he also was there for the beginning of J. Edgar Hoover and the FBI's, rise to being a detective agency for the president, and the internment of Japanese Americans, of course, was something that happened during him, too.
That's right. So if you were an anti-war opponent as that war approached, as Pearl Harbor approached, you were going to be targeted, particularly if you're a high-profile figure, political or newspaper or whatever, radio. You were going to be targeted by Hoover's FBI for your political speech, for your opposition to American involvement in World War II. And then, of course, as you mentioned, after Pearl Harbor, FDR implements an executive order that imprisons 120,000 or so Japanese Americans and Japanese nationals who happened to be in the United States. Their property was seized. Most of these people had no admiration whatsoever for the Emperor of Japan. They were loyal American citizens. They lost everything. And FDR implemented that policy despite the opposition of J. Edgar Hoover and FDR's own attorney general, who said this is far too draconian. There might be a few cases of sabotage or subversion we need to crack down, but we don't need this wide dragnet that you've implemented.
Harry S. Truman, 33rd president, 1945 to 1953. I don't have a summary. Tell us about Truman.
Again, Truman, there are things to admire. I certainly admire his leadership during the Cold War. He was thrown into a very difficult spot with FDR's untimely death. But Truman's 1948 whistle-stop campaign against New York Governor Thomas Dewey was one of the most demagogic in American history, in that Truman suggested that if Dewey were to win, fascism would be a triumph for fascism in the United States. Now, if you know anything about Thomas Dewey, that is such an outlandish and irresponsible charge for a sitting American president to make. Dewey was a somewhat moderate Republican. He was not a fascist. You know, Truman would say that there are people around Dewey that, you know, are really no different than the Nazis. And so it's that kind of rhetoric. It succeeded. It helped Truman win in 1948, unexpectedly. But one of the downsides to that, among many, was that the Republicans were so furious at losing that election they hoped to win, that it helps Joe McCarthy and some of their demagogues turn around and point the finger at Truman and say, he's a communist and his administration is staffed with communists.
Richard Nixon, 37th president, 1969 until he resigned in 1974. I think that we are now into the modern era enough that many of our listeners will sort of know the machinations that Nixon held. But what can you say about Nixon? It seems like he was a super suspicious person at his core.
Yes, he was. Some would say paranoid. I'm not a psychiatrist, so I don't know if I'll use that term. But this was clearly a very scarred man who never forgot a slight. And so he carried into the Oval Office a real disdain for the Kennedys, for anyone from Harvard, for the media, for Hollywood, anti-war protests.
They were all out to screw him.
They were all
out to screw him. That was what he said on tape a lot.
Correct. And I have to add to this, Mike, he, I think, was, even though he surrounded himself with a number of Jewish advisors, it's a very odd situation, the number of times he would launch into these anti-Semitic tirades on these secret White House tapes that we can all hear. I mean, I can't even count the number of times. And what that had the effect of doing, Nixon tended to keep this stuff under wraps publicly, but what it had the effect of doing was his White House staff was well aware of these fears, of these concerns, and it affected policy during the Nixon years, and not in a positive way.
He's quoted in your book as saying, dividing the American people has been my main contribution to the national political scene. I not only plead guilty to this charge, but I am somewhat flattered by it. I just thought, wow, did he say that out loud or was that on the tape?
So that was actually his vice president, Spiro Agnew.
Oh, Agnew said that?
Agnew said that.
Oh, okay. I'm glad we clarified.
So, but you know, here is Nixon speechwriter Pat Buchanan feeding that type of speech to Spiro Agnew, Nixon's first vice president. And Agnew loved playing that role of a divider. Now, Nixon had come into office in 1968, pledging to heal the wounds over the Vietnam War and over the inner city turmoil, the riots. He was going to be a healer. And instead, he unleashes a vice president who revels in the fact that he's going to divide the American public and talks about positive polarization. And again, similar to some of the other presidents we've talked about, accuses the opposition of being un-American and, if not, outright treasonous. That's not the kind of statesmanship one should look for in a president or a vice president.
So now we're up to our 45th and 47th president, President Trump. Quote from your book, Donald Trump is in a league of his own when it comes to demeaning the presidency with his unceasing conspiracy mongering and his lack of knowledge of the world he inhabits. That's pretty harsh words.
Yeah, they're harsh. And, you know, I thought long and hard before putting something like that in this book. But I think that's an accurate statement. And I think Donald Trump has raised polarization to an art form. He thrives on it. His base seems to like it as well. I mean, the examples are legion. Every day there's a new instance of referring to an opponent as, you know, in the case of Kamala Harris, he called her stupid or retarded. You know, Biden gets the same treatment, Obama as well. Look, harsh campaign rhetoric has always been with us. But one other thing President Trump does is he monitors social media. He's got people who monitor it for him as well. There's a real sort of highway of information going back and forth between right-wing influencers and the Trump White House. And Trump will not hesitate in the least to circulate unfounded rumors that, you know, for instance, Ted Cruz's father, was involved in the Kennedy assassination, or Antonin Scalia was suffocated by a pillow. You know, immigrants are eating your pets. It doesn't matter. There's kind of a two-way street back and forth. When you have the President of the United States highlight posts from QAnon and other organizations that are, for lack of a better expression, off the wall, that's not a healthy situation. It poisons public discourse. And I think President Trump, you know, again, is in a league of his own when it comes to that.
As I read through the chapter on him, it was interesting that there were examples that I was like, oh, I remember that, that each of those would have been a presidential ending scandal. And there were so many that I had forgotten some of them. So, which I guess that kind of, you know, indicates the level to which his administrations have been like this.
Yeah, it is outstanding in terms of just the sheer weight, the sheer number of these types of statements that he either retweets or comes up with himself. I agree, Mike. I thought in 2016 or so when he said that John McCain was a loser because he was a prisoner of war, I figured that would be the end. But he said, you know, he could shoot somebody on Fifth Avenue or Madison Avenue and his base would stick with him. And so far they have. Now, by the way, you saw this phenomenon to a great extent as well with Andrew Jackson. If you can successfully convince the common man and woman that you're fighting some sort of deep state in Trump's case or banking elite in Jackson's case, they will stick with you through thick or thin. It's not healthy, but I think it's something we all have to acknowledge. If you appear to be fighting for the man in the street or the woman in the street, you can get away with a lot.
Let's wrap up with the positive note that your book wraps up upon, the 73% that weren't in that other category, or 83%, I guess. So you break down Abraham Lincoln, Calvin Coolidge, George Washington, John Quincy Adams, William Howard Taft, Dwight Eisenhower, John F. Kennedy, and George W. Bush as ones who did not dip their toe into demagoguery.
Yeah, and there's plenty of names on that list that I think will tick off folks.
Reading the George W. Bush as somebody who's my age who was there then, sure. it was an interesting perspective that he didn't lean into the anti-Islamic sentiment that was right there for the taking if he had wanted to.
That's right, Mike, and he paid a steep political price for that. In fact, to this day, a lot of Trump's base criticized Bush for saying Islam was a religion of peace and, you know, for not cracking down on the American Islamic community. I really see that as a courageous act on President George W. Bush's part. A week after 9/11, he shows up at a mosque in Washington, D.C., puts his arm around the imam and does say, these are our fellow Americans and they will be treated with respect. It irritated a lot of members of his base at that time. It irritates a lot of Trump's base to this day. And to me, that's an example of political courage, of statesmanship that you did not see, for instance, with FDR when he interned, you know, 120,000, 130,000 Japanese Americans.
As I read through I know about Lincoln. You know, I'm not a Lincoln scholar, but I kind of know the shape of who Abraham Lincoln was. And as I was reading that section in the book, all I could think was that through the lens of people who use the term woke as a pejorative, he was the wokest president we had. And I think that's ironic that the party of Lincoln is using woke as a pejorative.
Yeah, I agree, Mike. I mean, he was not an abolitionist. He gets criticized to some extent to this day.
And I don't mean just the race. I just mean how he lived his life would have been seen as that.
True. The man had a temperament that I think most mortals do not possess. I do not possess it. Let me give you one quick example. If there's anybody who could have invoked the politics of personal destruction, who could have spread rumors and attacked the character of an opponent, it was Lincoln vis-a-vis Jefferson Davis, the president of the Confederacy. Not once during Lincoln's time in the White House did he go after Jefferson Davis personally, nor did he go after the entire South. In other words, you read his second inaugural address, where he talks about the white Southerners, the Southern community, reading the same Bible, worshiping the same God. They are our fellow citizens. We will eventually have to welcome them back into the Union. This was a man who did not attack people. And, you know, in a way, this book is a plea. We can't all be Lincolns. I'm not. He's a rare individual in our history. But that Lincoln model is something that I'm lobbying for, in a sense, with this book and with my public speaking.
I'm going to end with a quote that I pulled that gave me a chill. And I'll tell you who said it afterwards. You'll know. America must be guided by the lights of learning and reason, or else those who confuse rhetoric with reality will gain the popular ascendancy with their seemingly swift and simple solutions to every problem. That was a speech that John F. Kennedy didn't get to give because that was what he was going to say with the day he was assassinated. And I just thought that kind of crystallized a lot.
It does, Mike. And one of the tragedies of the Kennedy assassination is it launched the sort of modern obsession with conspiracy theories that somehow the deep state took out President Kennedy in Dealey Plaza, that Lee Harvey Oswald was a patsy, whatever. I think if John F. Kennedy, and I realize this is, you know, I'm way out on a limb here, but that kind of speculation that has proven to be somewhat divisive, Kennedy would have rejected it and said, look, let's try to look at the evidence. Let's try to reason our way through this. Let's not apply our ideological predispositions and come up with a suspect.
Dr. Stephen Knott is a professor of American history and government at Ashland University and emeritus professor of national security affairs at the U.S. Naval War College. We've been discussing his forthcoming book, Conspirator in Chief, The Long Tradition of Conspiracy Theories in American Presidency. Dr. Knott, thank you for your time again.
Thank you.